Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1043, interview number 12 with Jim DiGenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 26th of the year 2018. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiGenio, the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed, about the JFK assassination and Jim Garrison's investigation in the same. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave.
We've been doing a deep dive with a lot of deep diving yet to do. We've been talking about Clay Shaw. Now, in our last couple of interviews before today, we talked about David Ferry, who was the first person that Garrison indicted. He took that very strange trip to Houston, ostensibly to go ice skating, or was it goose hunting? They didn't bring guns, and they didn't do any ice skating. And as it turns out, Ferry had been associated with Oswald since their CAP days. Ferry was a longtime intelligence officer and was deeply involved with, apparently, intelligence activities going back to his CAP group, running on up through the covert operations against Fidel Castro, pursuant to the Bay of Pigs, and was an intimate of the New Orleans crowd of Guy Bannister and many of the other anti-Castro operatives whom we have examined to date. We took a look at his networking with Clay Shaw, whom, after David Ferry died, Clay Shaw was the next person indicted by Garrison. We took a look at Shaw and Ferry working on behalf of Freeport Sulphur, which, as I mentioned in the end of our previous interview, that is one of the areas where we see Clay Shaw as a functionary of the highest echelons of the power elite. Freeport Sulphur, major corporate interests, people like John A. Whitney or Jock Whitney, and Godfrey Rockefeller of the Rockefellers. We then looked at Clay Shaw's intelligence CV going back to the Second World War and General Thrasher, on up through International House, the Rockefeller entity, which is something of a partner to the International Trademark. That was Shaw's operation. It was under the auspices of that that he took his trip to San Francisco, very conveniently giving him the alibi he had spoken of earlier. And also, International House was from the place where Lee Harvey Oswald, coincidentally enough, booked his passage to Europe to, quote, defect, unquote, to the USSR. We took a look at David Ferry, apparent schematic for an assassination plot against JFK in Dealey Plaza. We then looked at Clay Shaw and David Ferry discussing a plot to kill Kennedy involving, as Ferry put it, triangulation of fire, and then what Perry Russo, that witness, had seen as hypothetical, became only too real when Ferry spoke of going to Hammond, Louisiana, to give him cover. And Clay Shaw again spoke of going to the West Coast, which he did. He went to San Francisco, thereby transforming the discussion from hypothetical into concrete / operational. We were talking at the conclusion of our last interview, Jim, about Clay Shaw's domestic file. And I'd like to read a paragraph from 385 and then part of another paragraph. This talks about it. We'll talk about that and then move into the Permindex material. On page 385, you write, Peter Vey, that's V-E-A, discovered a very important document while at the National Archives in 1994. Attached to a listing of Clay Shaw's numerous contacts with the Domestic Contact Service, that's of the CIA, a listing was attached which stated that Shaw had a covert security approval in the project QK Enchant, E-N-C-H-A-N-T, and all of those are in capital letters. This was in 1967, and the present tense was used, meaning that Shaw was an active covert operator for the CIA while Garrison was investigating him. When William Davy took this document to former CIA officer Victor Marchetti, an interesting conversation ensued. As Marchetti looked at the document, he said, "That's interesting. He was doing something there," unquote. He then said that Shaw would not need a covert security clearance for domestic contacts service. He then added, quote, "This was something else. This would imply that he was doing some kind of work for the clandestine services," unquote. When Davy asked what branch of clandestine services that would be, Marchetti replied, quote, "The DOD, the Domestic Operations Division. It was one of the most secret divisions within the clandestine services. This was Tracy Barnes' old outfit. They were getting into things," unquote. The former CIA officer stopped to seemingly catch himself. Again, quoting, "Exactly what, I don't know. But they were getting into some pretty risky areas. And this is what E. Howard Hunt was working for at the time," unquote. And in fact, Howard Hunt did have such a covert clearance issued to him in 1970 while he was working at the White House. That Jim, is some spicy meatball, as that old Alka-Seltzer commercial put it. We've touched on this, but I would like you to develop really what it is that Marchetti is saying. And I think I read that in part because I think one of the most important aspects of that is literally between the lines. Quite obviously, Marchetti was not coming forward with all of what he knew, and he was speaking in a guarded fashion. And that, it reminds me of Dean Andrews' anxieties about coming clean about who Clay Bertram really was. QK Enchant. Tell us what little you were able to about that, and bearing in mind that also was a clearance that E. Howard Hunt had at the same time.
Right. This is one of the most interesting documents that was declassified by the ARB, right, in which one of their analysts, in almost a throwaway line, said that she named Shaw's security approval, covert security approval number, and said it was assigned to Project QK Enchant. Now, what Marchetti's saying here, like any good intelligence analyst would, is that, wait a minute, you don't need a covert security approval in the businessman's program, all right? That's ridiculous, all right? So, in other words, this covert security approval would have had to have been, you know, for a different, more a clandestine type department of the CIA. And so he's suggesting that it very might well be that Shaw is involved with DOD, the Domestic Operations Divisions, which, as he said in there, that was a relatively new. See, and what makes that important is this. The CIA is not supposed to operate domestically. All right? It's not part of their charter. All right? They are supposed to do operations only abroad. So when Tracy Barnes opened up this Domestic Operations Division in the United States, all right, it was a violation of the CIA charter. Okay? So in other words, it was illegal. All right? Not that that means anything to the CIA, but technically speaking, it was illegal. And it's always so interesting, of course, that Hunt should also be involved in the DOD, and he should also have the same covert security approval. Because I'm sure on your show in the many, 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 many years you've been on, that you've discussed the whole curious aspect of Hunt retiring, supposedly, from the CIA to work for the Mullen Company, which was a CIA shell, a CIA front, as masquerading as an advertising agency, and then from there being employed by Charles Colson as part of the plumbers unit inside the White House. And all the you know, all the thing, I'm sure you've talked about that, right, Dave?
Sure. Yeah, over the, I'm now in my 40th year on the air. So, the Mullen Company and E. Howard Hunt is in the archives. It is, fairly far back, but the crew that initially coalesced, in the early 50s to overthrow our Benz, then, has an old lang syne reunion to deal with Castro in Cuba. That reunion didn't go as planned, and they continue forward through Mongoose, through, as we have seen, the JFK assassination. And they were to manifest, many times after Watergate, then, Operation Condor, the assassination of Orlando Letelier. And many of these same people, like Felix Rodriguez and Luis Posada Carriles, then crop up in connection with the Iran-Contra.
Right, and if you take a look at Watergate and the Kennedy assassination, you know, it's so interesting because you have people like Hunt, all right? You have people like Jim McCord, who was supervising the CIA's anti-FPCC program, at least in 1961. You have people like Richard Helms. You have people like Frank Sturgis, you know, in the background, et cetera. You know, and it's oh so odd that Hunt, yet Marchetti should say, boy, that was when Tracy Barnes was doing all those bizarre things, you know, with the department, the Domestic Operations Department. You know, and so as you, I'm sure you explored, there's a lot of people, including Jim Hogan, who believe that Watergate might have very well have been a CIA provocation, all right? And I'm sure you've discussed that on your show,
yeah.
You know? And so that's why I was so interested in the fact that Shaw and Hunt would have this same covert security approval, which the CIA has tried to deny. They tried to deny this for 30 years. That Shaw had any such thing, you know? In other words, they were lying about this. And so whenever, you know, you encounter something like this, you know, you have to ask, well, why were they lying about it for so long, you know? It naturally attracts attention to itself.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, why would you deny this for decades upon decades upon decades, knowing that it's a phony story?
Well, the thing that is, again, I read this in part to show how Marchetti was reacting. That's interesting. He was doing something there. I guess he was.
Yes.
And then he goes on to say, this was something else. This would imply that he was doing some kind of work for the clandestine services. And then he goes on to say, the DOD, Domestic Operations Division, it was one of the most secret divisions within the clandestine services. This was Tracy Barnes' old outfit. They were getting into things, the former CIA officer stopped to catch himself. Exactly what, I don't know. But they were getting, and he knew full well, because he didn't want to end up like the way so many of the rest of them did. And, you know, he's catching himself here, because he's telling us the truth. He also realizes that he could become what Monty Python referred to as an ex-alibit here, if he makes the wrong exactly what, I don't know. But they were getting into some pretty risky areas, yes, indeed. And this is what E. Howard Hunt was working for at the time. Hunt, maybe the most important of the Bay of Pigs operatives, then, you know, hates Kennedy, co-authors, or really ghostwrites the piece in Fortune magazine with Alan Dulles, lambasting Charles Murphy piece, lambasting JFK for Bay of Pigs. And E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas on 11-22-63, along with David Phillips, rather, and a lot of other people. And has it ever come out, Jim, what Q, K, and Chant literally was? I've wondered about that, the enchant.
My knowledge, no, it has not ever been revealed exactly what QK enchant was supposed to represent. Oh, let me correct something that you said. Mm-hmm. Garrison actually did not indict David Ferry. He was on the verge of indicting him.
Oh, okay.
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 When he ended up dead.
Okay, right? So he never actually booked Ferry. Ferry
right.
Bought the farm
that's
before
correct.
That happened. Okay, I stand corrected. Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
I'm going to read part of one more paragraph as something of a transition, because Clay Shaw, again, it's been made out that, well, he was just a businessman. He was gay. He was persecuted because he was gay, because Garrison was a publicity seeker. He was ambitious, blah, blah, blah. You write again on page 385, the next step in the CIA ladder after his high-level overseas informant service was his, Clay Shaw's, work for the strange company called Permindex. When the announcement for Permindex was first made in Switzerland in late 1956, its principal backing was to come from a local banker named Hans Seligman. But as more investigation by the local papers was done, it became clear that the real banker was J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation. This information was quite revealing. Schroeder's had been closely associated with Alan Dulles and the CIA for years. Alan Dulles' connections to the Schroeder banking family went back to the 30s, when his law firm Sullivan and Cromwell first began representing them through him. Later, Dulles was the bank's general counsel. In fact, when Dulles became CIA director, Schroeder's was a repository for a $50 million contingency fund that Dulles personally controlled. Schroeder's was a welcome conduit because the bank benefited from previous CIA overthrows in Guatemala and Iran. Another reason that there began to be a furor over Permindex in Switzerland was the fact that the bank's founder, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, was associated with the Third Reich, specifically Heinrich Himmler. And you write more about that. The reason I wanted to read that, Jim, and I'm going to have you develop this for us, over the many decades when I talk about the Third Reich and Alan Dulles' work post-war with the Galen Organization and the negotiations he was involved with while the war was actually going on, Alan Dulles, like his brother John Foster Dulles, had the most profound links to Nazi Germany and the insidious elements in that going back to the 1930s. One of the things that I spoke about in a program I did in 1980 was the Sonder Konto S, or Special Account S. That was the bank account in the Schroeder Bank that bankrolled the day-to-day operations of the Nazi SS. And what the primary industrialists would do is they would contribute, the financiers, they would contribute to that, and in turn, they got the pick, so to speak, of the SS slave labor pool. One of the subsidiaries of J. Henry Schroeder, you don't write about it here, but it's Schroeder Rockefeller and Company, with a Schroeder and Percy Rockefeller operation. The point being, and this is really not something that I can do justice to, but over the years I've heard people saying, well, Dave Emery thinks everybody's a Nazi, blah, 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 blah. The post-war, Hogan's Heroes nonsense, or even the not-so-ludicrous things, have really blinded us to the networking. And people say conspiracy, it has so many connotations, to the networking that was going on between powerful elements of our oligarchy and their corresponding elements abroad. And I'm going to turn things over to you in a section, but you, in your bibliography, you note the book All Honorable Men by James Stuart Martin. It's a book I have for download on my website, and it chronicles Martin's unsuccessful attempts at interdicting these transnational globalist corporate networks, which result in basically the Third Reich and a lot of other things. And the point that I think is central here is that Clay Shaw was part and parcel to this whole nexus. Now, I've said the mouthful, and it's bad radio, Jim. I owe you and the audience a degree of apology. But you know, in the other decades that I've been on the air, I've been trying to make this point. And the point, I guess, that I'm really harping on here, and that you do a wonderful job of locating Clay Shaw in this firmament, is that Clay Shaw was part and parcel to these networks, which on the one hand one could say is Nazi or fascist, but which also go to the Rockefellers, to Sullivan and Cromwell, to the very primary engines of Wall Street. Going back, you know, the QK and Chant is not something that you've never seen the reference to that. Develop Permindex for us. You write much more about that, but I realize I've been sort of obsessive here, but this, you get into a point that I've been trying to make for decades, that this is not a bunch of lone nuts at work here. And Schroeder, Allen Dulles, Sullivan, and Cromwell, when we see Clay Shaw as a player on this stage, it is very significant.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Because as you've been describing, you know, this whole network of secret connections, which the Schroeder thing is so important, okay, because that connects straight to Allen Dulles. You know, Dulles was a director of that banking unit, and that banking unit had direct ties into the Nazis and to the CIA. And so, you know, to finally reveal after all these years of controversy that went on in Switzerland that Permindex was really the main underwriter for this mysterious company, you know, I think that was very, very important, you know, because as what's come out, of course, is that, and by the way, this is new stuff, which I didn't actually get into my book, all right, is that the Permindex connection is international. It's very widespread. It's very, very powerful. It goes even to a level above the CIA, all right? It goes to a level, the top level of what we call the international power elite, mm-hmm. You know, to the Rothschilds and to the Rockefeller Group. And that, of course, goes over to what would, you know, the real heavy hitters, the Bilderbergers and things like that, you know. So, and Permindex is connected to that because the newest stuff we have coming out of the Bloomfield archive, okay, in Montreal, is that Mr. Bloomfield, who was supposed to be the corporate counsel for that company, was going ahead and calling those kinds of people, the Rothschilds and David Rockefeller's office, and they were soliciting funds. And then Franck Nagy, who was on the board, was then offering to go ahead and use Permindex for CIA operations. We actually have that now in documents. You know, this is something we didn't have before. You know, this is something we had to put together through circumstantial evidence. But now we actually have the what they call the direct evidence, you know. And so this makes all the other things, you know, for example, about Maurice Gatlin and his courier service to $200,000 through Permandex for the assassination of de Gaulle through the OAS, that makes that all the more credible now. You know, and Jim Garrison was apparently correct. You know, many people have tried to knock this down. You know, the whole Permandex Central Mondial Commercial connection. They've tried to, you know, make fun of it. They've tried to say it was a KGB stunt. They tried to say that, you know, that Shah really wasn't involved with it, and, you know, and all this is a bunch of, as they say, you know, tinfoil hat stuff. Well, it turned out that it all ended up being true.
Yeah. Okay. And one of the reasons, Jim, that I went into the length and depth and that sort of open-ended rant was exactly that. I have seen almost no treatment of Permandex when they mention it at all, except, you know, oh, my God, as you put it, tinfoil hat material. And yet it not only isn't that, but it goes to the very top echelons of the power elite. As you know, the CIA is, you know, it's basically they're on demand. They get things done. But when you go up to, you examine people like Dulles and Sullivan and Cromwell, which it's pedigree going back to the Morgans, even John Foster Dulles. He was named for his grandfather, John Watson Foster, who was Benjamin Harrison's Secretary of State and engineered the first overthrow of a foreign government, which was the destabilization of Queen Liliuokalani in Hawaii, which then became a territory, now is a state. But these are networks that go to the very essence of not only American power structure, but international power structure and the creation of cartels, which are really the dominant power entities on Earth. Not just transnational corporations, but consortia of transnational corporations. And that's what Permandex is. I had never read, I've read about Permandex. I had never seen the Schroeder connection until reading Destiny Betrayed. And I was blown away. I was just amazed. And again, Dulles maintained a $50 million fund there. The SS maintained their operational fund in the Sonderkommando S for Schroeder. So it is a very historically important organization, runs through the Bank of International Settlements, and things I just don't have time to go into here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
You mentioned, Jim, that Frank Nagy was plotting against talking about using Permandex against Charles de Gaulle of France, and he was a friend of Jacques Soustelle of the OAS. And I wonder if you would restate for us Maurice Burke's Gatlin, and also René Soueffre of Soueffre, and where he was on 11-22-63.
All right. The Soustelle was one of the top leaders of the renegade French military operation called the OAS. All right. The OAS was a group of officers who had been detailed to Algeria to somehow contain the Algerian rebellion against French colonialism there. It didn't work out very well. And so when de Gaulle came back into office, he announced a plan that he was going to go ahead and allow Algeria to eventually become its own independent state. And these guys didn't like it, all right? And so they made various attempts to go ahead and do away with Charles de Gaulle, all right? And we have this information about Gatlin, who had been a friend of Guy Bannister's, all right, and who had worked on the Guatemalan operation, you know, and part of the so-called anti-communist League of the Caribbean with Bannister. And he was supposedly have transported a couple of $100,000 to transfer to Permindex to invest through another bank to fund one of these assassination operations against Charles de Gaulle, right? And this, of course, makes it all the more interesting. You know, what the heck was Shaw doing on the board of directors of this company? You know, what was this so-called, this free trade guy who was doing renovations in New Orleans in the French Quarter, you know, who tried to fancy himself as a Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy liberal? What was he doing mixed up with these people? You know, and then this, of course, extends, its ultimate extension is to a man named René Soutra, who was reportedly in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on the day of the Kennedy assassination. And he was reportedly one of these OAS guys who was, the reports have it, that he was picked up, you know, and exported out of the country. You know, we never got to the bottom. What the heck was he doing there in the first place? You know, this is one of the things the Warren Commission should have been all over. You know, what the heck was this guy doing in the Dallas-Fort Worth area on the day of the assassination? You know, is that just another one of these utterly amazing coincidences, you know, that are pop up all over this case? You know, or was there some hidden meaning behind it? You know, and so, you know, this is the amazing, the more you excavate this, as you said earlier, the more you excavate this, the more you see this whole secret world that was supposed to remain hidden, that was never supposed to be exposed to the general public, you know, whatever you want to call it, the shadow government, all right, the deep political structure, okay, the invisible government, or whatever, all right? That's what happened with the JFK case. That's what a problem he presented to the power elite, that they would actually risk exposing a large part of this hidden network, yep, which they wouldn't have had to expose, you know, if Kennedy had lived.
You mentioned, Jim, in one of our earlier interviews that, in fact, Kennedy in 1958 made a speech on the floor of the Senate talking about how bankrupt the French attempt at squelching Algerian independence was. He was lambasted for that, and yet ultimately achieved something of prophet status in that regard. So that, the point being that JFK was not only ahead of his time, but was on the speech of the U.S. Senate in 1958. And a lot of people alive today can't remember how reactionary things were back then. But he was making speeches on behalf of Algerian independence and against the stated policies of a U.S. ally at that point in time. And that places him once again on the other side of the aisle from people like Jacques Soustelle, Frank Nage, René Soutra, Maurice Brooks Gatlin et al. One more thing.
It was actually 57.
With 57? Okay, I stand for 57 when he made the speech on the floor of the U.S. And one year after Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon got reelected, something else I didn't know about Yalmar Shock, or about Clay Shaw, Freudian slip, on page 386, you write that one of the friends of Clay Shaw's one of the directors of Permindex was the son-in-law of Yalmar Shock, who was a friend of Shaw's. I didn't realize that Shaw was friendly with Yalmar Shock.
Well, if that's what I wrote in there, then it must be true. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
It must have been through the Permindex Association.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense. Yalmar Schacht was Adolf Hitler's finance minister. He also handled the arrangements in the early 20s to basically set up a money go-round to alleviate Germany's problems with the reparations settlements. There was the Dawes and the Young Plan, and that involved the U.S. basically lending Germany the money to repay its war debts, and that led to a pattern of economic concentration. The Dulles is, by the way, deeply involved with that. Hjalmar Schacht's full name is Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. And he was...
that's funny.
Yeah, that was his full name. He was actually born in the U.S., and that was got the name Horace Greeley. And I guess, like his namesake, he decided to go west, young man.
Yes.
And
I didn't know that, by the way. That's interesting.
It is. And Hjalmar Schacht was, I mean, I could go on for hours about him, but I just thought that Clay Shaw's association with someone like that, like with his association with the Schroeder Nexus and Alan Dulles, going on the one hand to Heinrich Himmler and the SS, and then on the other hand to the overthrow of Arbenz and Mossadegh in Iran, or in Guatemala and Iran, respectively, is really revealing of who Clay Shaw was. And as you put it, Jim, rather very expertly, as we look at the JFK assassination, and one of the main reasons that I'm going into the depth that I am in this book is, I mean, it's history. It's over. He's been dead for more than 50 years. More than half the people alive today weren't even born when he was killed. But when you really study this book, and I know that James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, on a cover endorsement said this book should be studied, and I agree. You really begin to see how power works in this country and even beyond this country. And that really, I think, is the thing that's so important about Clay Shaw. I mean, the other information we spoke about is obviously important, but this guy was a major power operative. And I was just blown away by your coverage of Permindex. It's treated like, little paper doll cutouts. I mean, it is treated in a ludicrous sense almost always, and yet not only is it not ludicrous, but it is very, very, very profound indeed. Tell us about what Regis Kennedy had to say in connection with Shaw and Permindex, also from page 386.
Oh, that's interesting. Regis Kennedy, of course, was one of the major players in the FBI New Orleans office. Right. And from my understanding, he was one of the few guys there who spoke fluent Spanish. All right. And so Hoover put him on the Cuban exile beat. All right. He was also at the trial of Clay Shaw. He revealed that he was on the Kennedy case immediately after the assassination, and one of his functions was to find Clay Bertrand, all right? And he revealed to someone, one of Garrison's informants, that he had the understanding that Shaw had done some work internationally for the CIA for 5 years, and it had been located in Italy, which perfectly matches, of course, what Shaw was doing with Permindex in Rome. So, again, here you have another guy, who understands, a law enforcement officer, who understands, who Clay Shaw really is, but, of course, cannot talk about it. All right? So that's the kind of stuff, again, I say, that Garrison was up against.
Indeed, and he was up against what the aforementioned James Douglas termed JFK and the Unspeakable, and Regis Kennedy could not do that. Digressing ever so slightly, Jim, in your other treatments of Regis Kennedy, he appears to me to be someone who was of good intent, but once again was constrained by the institutions around him and for which he worked.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good judgment, okay, that Regis Kennedy was being constrained by the higher-ups above him in both the FBI and the Department of Justice. If Regis Kennedy would have been allowed to testify freely, on the other hand, I think he would have corroborated a lot of the things that Jim Garrison was, as they say, pulling up underneath these hidden rocks, you know, because Regis Kennedy, as I said, was working the anti-Castro Cuban exile beat. And there's even reports he was actually in Bannister's office more than once. So, yes, yeah, I think you're right about that. It's unfortunate that, you know, that the FBI was so much in to the JFK assassination cover-up, because I think Regis Kennedy, you know, would have helped Garrison a lot.
He was one of many people who died on the eve of the, or as the House Select Committee on Assassinations hearings were gathering momentum. I've wondered if the timing of his demise was surfaced to keep him from revealing what he might have revealed. But before we get to the CIA and Clay Shaw, I mean, their interest in the case, another of Shaw's interesting links was to WDSU and the Stern family. We've mentioned that briefly, but WDSU and Carlos Springer and Lee Harvey Oswald, those are links that are obviously relevant to the investigation.
Yes. The Stern family, which were heirs to the Sears Roebuck fortune, were the owners of WDSU, which was the NBC affiliate there in New Orleans. They were, to put it mildly, they were very much working for the cause of Clay Shaw. All right, I don't think there's any question about that. All right, and so they sponsored a lot of the activities that Walter Sheridan did, okay, because they worked out of that studio. They used some of the reporters, all right, and I go into at length and depth about some of the very, very weird and bizarre things that Sheridan did in order to put together this hatchet job on Garrison. And WDSU backed him all the way, you know. And then later on, before, in 1963, one of the programs that Oswald went on TV, you know, I think it was either TV or radio, was done from the studios of WDSU. And those were, if you recall, after he was arrested with his, for his dispute with Carlos Bringier on Canal Street in New Orleans, and then it, miraculously, even though Bringier threw the punch, he was not fined. Oswald was the recipient of the punch, and he was fined, all right? He then did a couple of radio shows. I think one was a TV show, actually. And to bring more attention to what he had done, and one of them was out of WDSU. So WDSU and the Sterns were very much in the picture here as part of New Orleans high society that decided they were going to come down on Jim Garrison like a ton of bricks.
Indeed, and they most assuredly did.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Jim, we've been talking about Clay Shaw's profound links to the CIA and even beyond that, his links to the power elite whose judgments are executed literally by CIA and other intel agencies abroad. You write in Destiny Betrayed about the Garrison Group. This was an actual informal but apparently quite important and secretive group within CIA. Tell us about the CIA Garrison Group and their interest in Jim Garrison.
Oh, this is very interesting, because if you look at this, Garrison was getting clobbered by the media at this time. You know, Newsweek, Saturday Evening Post, all right, all the newspapers, the major newspapers, all right. And then this culminated in the NBC hatchet job called the Case of Jim Garrison. All right. And I deal a lot with this in my book. But he still wouldn't go away. All right. He wouldn't go ahead and put his head between his, head between his legs and jump on the bed and disappear. So what happened is that in around early September of 1967, the CIA convened a meeting of something called the Garrison Group. And if I recall correctly, there were about six or seven people there, going all the way up to Deputy Director for Richard Helms, who was a guy named Thomas Karamanidis. And there was also James Angleton's deputy director, a guy named Ray Rocha. All right? Ray Rocha is very important because he is essentially going to be the counterintelligence guy running all the files that they were going to accumulate on Jim Garrison, which were absolutely mammoth. All right? I mean, really, the files that they had on the Garrison case, if one person would sit in a library 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, it would take them 5 years to read all this stuff. That's how much they had on this guy. All right. And so at this meeting, Rocha begins the meeting, and I'm paraphrasing what he said. He said words of the effect, if allowed to continue, Jim Garrison will gain a conviction of Clay Shaw. All right? Now, you can imagine the way that went over at this meeting, all right, which was supposed to be convened about certain things about what are we going to do about this guy before, during, and after the trial of Clay Shaw.
Again, Virgin, your exact words that you wrote on page 270. Rocha then said something quite ominous. He said that he felt, quote, and you have the footnote for this quote, that Garrison would indeed obtain a conviction of Clay Shaw for conspiring to assassinate President Kennedy, unquote. That is really important. Obviously it's important, but again, in the context of the outright propaganda that has been generated about Garrison, you know, again, the homophobe, the mob shill, the publicity seeker, blah, blah, blah. That is really, and Clay Shaw, Mr. Clean, as Garrison termed it, that is really important. That's another thing that I was amazed to see in your book. I didn't realize that Rocha had made, it wouldn't surprise that someone would have made the statement, but this in a meeting of the Garrison Group.
Right, right. And that came pretty early in the meeting. So now, clearly what's happening here is the CIA is getting really, really, really worried about what Garrison is now going to be able to achieve now that he's gone ahead and made it through this media barrage. And so this meeting, and I think I had evidence that there were four meetings of this group, all right? And the paper trail on each is less and less and less until finally at the end, at the fourth meeting, all that says is Garrison Group, all right? There's about three sentences after that. So clearly what's happening is, if you're familiar with how the CIA operates, they were putting this stuff more and more into back rooms at Langley and discussing it off the record about what they're going to do about this guy. All right? That's what clearly was happening, you know. And, you know, the fact that they began, there's one of these I did have, okay, in which they talked about task forces, you know. And that document was so heavily redacted, it only had about, you know, three sentences that you could read, but that was one of them. So what I did is I put together in my book clearly what their actions had been and what they contemplated and what they actually did, you know, which I could actually prove, all right? And so I spent several pages on that, you know, in the book, showing that they were meeting with judges in order to not to accept subpoenas from Garrison. Sometimes they even maneuvered themselves to meet with New Orleans representatives not to sign the subpoenas that Garrison requested. You know, they actually talked to witnesses, you know, that Garrison had in order to talk them out of their stories, et cetera. You know, so those are the kind of things that they were determined to do. And this went on, as Helms' memo said, not just before, but during and after the trial. These actions the CIA took to interfere with a New Orleans prosecution in the Kennedy case. And again, I could not have done this stuff, you know, without the declassified files of the ARB.
Well, it is very revealing and substantively so. And again, you wrote, we'll get to the trial, but there appears to have been an actual task force in New Orleans for the Clayshaw trial. And you are of the opinion that was basically an extension, an operational offshoot of the Garrison Group.
Yes, I because Helms' original memo said actions before, during, and after the trial. And that's what they did. They designed actions to subvert Garrison in the investigatory phase, during the trial, and after the trial to get him out of office.
And another, in addition to Ray Rocha, well, we should mention that Rocha was Angleton's assistant, his deputy.
Yes.
And we should also briefly, because we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, but Angleton was running the false defector program into the former Soviet Union, in which Oswald was apparently a participant.
Yes. I think that's accurate. All the indications we have are Angleton was a part of the false defector program, and I did everything I could to prove in my book that Oswald was certainly a part of that. So this is why Angleton would have all this paper through Rocha on the Garrison investigation.
And we remember what happened to Otto Hotepka when he wanted to innocently look into that. He kicked the hornet's nest, as it were. Jim, with regard to Clay Shaw and his culpability, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, we'll get to that down the road, but when they convened, their deputy counsel or assistant counsel for the New Orleans area had some interesting things to say about Clay Shaw. I wonder if you would fill in Mr. Blackmer's his observations.
Yeah, Jonathan Blackmer worked a lot with Jim Garrison at the beginning of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and he did oral interviews with Jim Garrison, and Garrison trusted him enough to give him a lot of the raw files he had left. And he came away convinced that Clay Shaw was very much possibly either a cutout to the planners or actually one of the planners of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That's how convinced Blackmer was of Garrison's case. So that, of course, we'll talk about what happened in the House Select Committee. But that's the kind of thing that you had in the early days of the House Select Committee before people like Sprague and Tannenbaum were forced to leave.
And that, again, from Jonathan Blackmer, the assistant counsel for the New Orleans area, opining that Clay, from on the basis of what he had uncovered, that Clay Shaw was either a planner of or a cutout to the planners of the assassination of JFK, and coupling that with Angleton's deputy Ray Roca, the CIA sort of go-to man for the Garrison investigation and the JFK assassination investigation, Ray Roca's opinion that, in fact, Jim Garrison would obtain a guilty conviction of Clay Shaw in connection with the assassination of JFK, which those two points of information stand in stark contrast to the tsunami of disinformation about Garrison, the investigation, and even the assassination to which we have been subjected. And they're as detailed as these talks have been and as the future talks will be. I want to emphasize for the listeners that there is an awful lot more than even in this long series of interviews we could cover. So as James Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable Council, in a cover endorsement of Destiny Betrayed, this is a book that should be studied. And we're past holiday gift-giving season, but I don't think that should affect the commercial judgment of any member of the audience. This would make a very worthwhile investment if you're reading, or something to help a friend invest in. Jim, we will be talking more about some of what happened to Jim Garrison and his investigation, the infiltrators, the way the media, you made a reference to
Walter Sheridan.
Walter Sheridan, indeed. An amazing view of how our media really work. And I think in terms of understanding American power structure, the Walter Sheridan and other media people who basically function as an extension of the national security establishment, there's no aspect of your book that is more important. We have about 4 minutes left. Tell people about not only Destiny Betrayed, but JFK, the evidence today about Kennedy's and King and Black Op Radio.
Yeah, certainly. All right. My website is kennedysandking.com, and you'll see a lot of information, including book reviews, film reviews, research articles, on the four major assassinations of the 60s there, JFK, MLK, Malcolm X, and RFK. And you'll also see click-throughs if you want to buy my two most recent books. That would be the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the one that we're discussing here, which is Destiny Betrayed, the second edition. And also I'm a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show out of Vancouver, his radio show on Thursday nights called Black Op Radio.
Alrighty, so that is where people can learn more. That's where people can get the hold of the book. And I recommend to people that they do just that. Again, I owe the audience a degree of apology, and you too, Jim, for reading as much as I did. That's not good radio, but I was, again, reading the book, and I've been, you know, I'm a veteran JFK assassination researcher, although not by any means exclusively. But I was blown away when I read the book, not only the QK and Champ information, but again, Permindex, and with links running to people like the institutions like the Schroeder Bank, and Hjalmar Horace Greeley shocked Hitler's first finance minister. It just, again, we talk about networking going all the way back to the early 20s and the Dawes and Young plan and the Dulles' involvement with that. And it really, I think, indicates what was at stake, as you put it, the networks that could have been revealed if this case had been properly investigated. And you've certainly helped us to do that. This concludes For the Record, program number 1043, interview number 12 with Jim DiAgemio about Destiny Betrayed. This concludes the program. This is being recorded on December 26th of the year 2018. For Jim DiAgemio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.